Let's once again benefit from the transition from whatever you were doing, you know, just Saturday being Saturday, and coming to this and just noticing how that feels. Once again, I point us towards this question that's always operating in something like this. Why are we even doing this? Why are we here? Perhaps we can come to some appreciation of the operating of wholesome intention rather than take it for granted. The path is hard enough. There's enough confronting what's difficult in the personality and the personality of other people and life in general. So where there is something good like this wholesome intention to see things as they are, to incline the mind towards relinquishment and kindness, it's good to remember that, to pay attention to it. So let's leave the silent space that allows that. Noticing that mindfulness is operating here. This aspect that one of my teachers, the Venerable Puniji Mahatera, very aptly names just the introversion of attention. Like, what's going on in here? Why am I here? And sense into the wholesome intention. I imagine it's the case that many of you have engaged in some formal meditation practice. And so to the extent that we just allow this formal, individual, silent time, perhaps we can see how this part of the path, right mindfulness, right samadhi, right calm concentration, is clear, obvious, and it refines this capacity to know the inner world as it's forming and reforming. leaving space in this very life. To get intimate with how things are, not to bounce across the surface with multitasking. Reading things that we skim over, media that glances across the senses, can we be intimate with experience? Maybe just find one touch point in the body, because it's so simple, one touch point that draws your attention now. Maybe it's where the body touches the chair on the bottom or the back, or maybe it's the feet or the hands, the nostrils, the eyes. See for yourself what's prominent now, and noticing the capacity to turn attention towards this particular phenomena and to see what it's like. What is this sensing experience? Is what you are sensing nearby, or is it far away? Can you even locate it in space definitively? See for yourself. To let go of your assumptions about the nature of experience. Is awareness one thing and the object, the sensing, the contact, is it a separate thing? See if you can determine that. Have a look. Is the observation of this contact happening in the past or in the future, or is it happening now? See if you can locate that tip of the moment that's right in between past and future. See if you can locate now. It's quicker than words. It's quicker than thought. You can't grab it. It's a kind of surrender. The Buddha refers to samadhi as having two primary qualities. The mind is tranquil and gathered, collected. If we pause for this moment and look for the experience of tranquility, serenity, what do you see? What do you experience? What parts of the body are relaxed? And of the mind. Is it willing to rest just right here with my speaking, with the body sitting? Can the mind stabilize? Gather, collect itself. So the bell is a kind of transition. One of the gifts of the type of Buddhist culture that's emerged in the West among convert Buddhists, like most of us, is a tremendous amount of attention given to these path factors of right mindfulness, samasati, and right samadhi, right calm, gathered stillness, so-called right concentration, sama samadhi. And so there's a lot of retreat centers and some very skillful teachers, a lot of resources and a lot of books. And one of the challenges that we face as we explore the totality of the Eightfold Path is understanding how that very beautiful and powerful aspect of Buddha Dhamma fits into and relates to the whole of the path and all of the other path factors. And where I'll begin, just to touch into this, to give us some context. So what's the purpose of the path? And we will talk more about this tomorrow morning. What's the purpose of the path? Well, suffering and the end of suffering. It's the path to the, you know, diminishing of all those factors, that all those qualities that keep us trapped. We talked about ignorance, for example, where we're just blind to the impermanent nature of things. We're blind to our own suffering. We've covered it over enough with enough distractions or pleasant things that we don't actually see the way the mind is constantly trying to gobble up something new, constantly trying to find the next pleasure or avoid the next pain. The relational distresses, we lose track of those. The being embedded in such social dysfunction, and we don't see our part in that sort of massive systemic stuff, but we feel it. We live with the tension within us. We live unfree. So we've seen something of ignorance. And we've seen, perhaps, in your dialogue, for example, meeting other people, and like someone talked about how, you know, wanting to validate what they're saying and so on, and sort of helps them feel good about themselves, which helps us feel good about themselves. This sort of mutual becoming in Pali Bhava, the stabilizing of the self that we're constantly doing, like, am I safe? How am I? Who am I? Do they like me? Do I look good? And when our looking good, our accomplishments, things that we're proud of and identify with are threatened, I am threatened. And then I strike out, I act badly, hatred, let's say, arises, violence arises, cruelty arises, unhappiness arises for myself and for others. And that bhava, that becoming, is driving this I am that's at the core of that. My possessions, my home, my family. You insult my family, you insult me. My promotion, my money, my power. I'll get more power because it's one way I can build a wall around myself and strengthen my existence in the world, protect myself. And that's bhava, bhava. And we are intoxicated by it, just like we're intoxicated by ignorance. The mind becomes flooded. In the same way that it becomes flooded by this endless search for pleasure and endless avoiding of pain. The foods, the drinks, the clothing, the appearance, the nice words, the entertainments. One way to think of it, if you like, is Facebook is about bhava, Amazon is about the kama, the pleasure. So those are powerful forces. They manifest in action, in corporate structures, financial trends. And the reason that this is all related to the path is because when we're flooded by these things, asava, the so-called taints or floods, these intoxicants, when we're flooded and intoxicated, we cause suffering for ourselves, for others, and both, and we don't even know in those moments of intoxication that there's a path. It's all about whatever that moment's obsession is. So, the path, logically, must address this problem of intoxication. Now, right view practices like we've been doing, like we're doing right now, this is a practice of right view. Remember that? That the voice of another, wise attention, are the conditions for the arising of right view. And the actual practices of right view within those conditions are discussion. This is out of the suttas, by the way. Discussion, study. That's in the discourses, yeah. Tranquility, morality, and insight. So, this practice of discussion right now is a practice of right view that addresses part of the ignorance at issue, but not without mindfulness, right? Because then we just fall in, the Dhamma doesn't have chance to work, we're just off in bozo land, you know? So, we're going to give some time in a little bit to the parts of the path in it that are, shall we say, the bulk of our everyday lives. The ignorance is addressed by insight as well as by right view. And so samadhi and sati, mindfulness and calm concentration, are practices to cultivate insight. And so they help us wake up enough that the habit of ignorance and all that flows from it, the incredible lack of skill, the hurt for ourselves and others, we can wake up to the nature of that harm, see that it hurts us. Ignorance is not knowing that it hurts. We think everything's groovy, or at least that that's normal to hurt ourselves and others all the time. with our distractions, our pain, our selfishness. So waking up is waking up to this very human stuff, as well as to the kind of the bottom underneath the substrate of the whole thing, which is what insight addresses, which is the very formation of self and world. But that's not going to do it. That's not good. That's not the whole of the path. That's part of the path. That's a beautiful and essential part of the path. But we need to understand how essential it is. And because it's privileged in Western Buddhism, the meditation part, I'm going to be focusing now on the other path factors and how they relate to these same floods, to the same problem of suffering. Are you with me so far? Okay, thanks. So, what does it mean to practice in a way that goes contrary to the bhava, the becoming, the centering of ourself, this me, as the most important, you know, little solid nut in the universe? What are we going to do about that? It seems so baked in. You're just going to meditate harder? And then yourself is going to get better at meditating. But the self is still very much intact. What about the rest of our lives? I once calculated, you know, with approximations, what percentage of our lives are actually in formal meditation practice. And I figured for someone who's pretty committed, you know, meditating every day and for a half hour to an hour, going to a one retreat a year, maybe they go to some little retreats in between. It was like 3% or something. What about the rest of that time? What's happening to form and reform the mind towards ignorance or towards wakefulness, towards delusion, towards insight? And above all, right now, towards the tightening and reifying, the strengthening of this sense of self, and then the building a world around it that protects this self. And then that's the life project, is protecting and getting, making, having, pleasuring the self. What's the path in relationship to that? That's our question. And the beautiful, very useful, not beautiful to the ear, but beautiful to you, you know, to the mind in terms of its impact, is this word effacement, which is what the Buddha said is the real point of the path, not the exotic states of jhana, the specific sutta, the effacement sutta, the Salaka sutta, and the Majjhima Nikaya. Very beautiful, powerful teaching. He said, someone comes and asks him, is it possible, sort of like even at the beginning, to have these, you know, special states and so on? The Buddha said, well, you can go have these special states, but that's not the point of the path. That's pleasant abiding here and now. The point of the path is effacement. And here's how you practice effacement. And then he gives this list. You know what it is, lists, right? But a list of 44 practices to address these 44 qualities, problematic qualities. And some of them are simply, you know, as you've heard of so many of them, you know, like wrong speech. We have right speech to overcome wrong speech. I mean, some of it's like, you know, seems a little, why, you know. But anyway, it's useful to say it. But when, as you look at the whole thing, it also includes, you know, the elevated knowledge and vision and, you know, all of the really bright, wonderful, shall we say, rarefied aspects of the path and its fruit. But most of it is stuff like, don't be, you know, don't be conniving, don't be dishonest, don't be cheating, take feedback easily rather than reject feedback, stuff like that. He's saying this is the path of effacement. So how does that translate into action for us? And how do we fit it into the path factors, all of these things? So we've already talked about right effort. So I'd like to give you a contemplation on right effort, and I'm going to include two kinds of application, because effort applies to every single path factor. Right, it's that engagement, it's the energy, it's the perseverance to actually, you know, be involved in this thing and in an active way. And the right effort is going to apply especially to right mindfulness and right samadhi, and the right effort to diminish unwholesome states and cultivate wholesome states. That's the classical right effort. Prevent the arising of the unarisen unwholesome. Abandon those unwholesome qualities in the mind that have already arisen. I want to put a little marker there because I'm going to talk about it in a second. To cultivate as yet undeveloped wholesome states and to maintain and increase the already developed wholesome states. Very schematic, very Buddhist in nature, but it can be very helpful. So this abandoning already arisen unwholesome states, to me, that sounds like what is sometimes derisively called the self-help project, but I'd like to look at the wholesome part of it, right? Because as long as it's not, you know, fixating on a me trying to get better so I can get more, you know, good vibes in the world, but we're really looking at the purifying nature of the mind. Well, what am I doing in my life to cultivate the mind in this way? To abandon unwholesome qualities like racism, patriarchy, insecure attachments, if you like that language, or trauma, if you like that language. All the psychological project fits in this, you know, exquisite way in this aspect of right effort. But we understand it's on the path not to make a shining, beautiful self, but it's just all these tangles that get in the way of seeing things as they are, and we behave badly when we're intoxicated by the self. Bhavasava, the intoxicant of becoming. So I'll restate this contemplation in just a moment with more concise precision. So don't worry about it. That's where we're going. But I want to talk about your practice now. You've worked some with pause and relax, you know, relax the body, mind, just receive things as they are now and open. Mindfulness established internally, externally, and both. Pause, relax, open. So I now would like to invite you to give some attention to this guideline, attuned to emergence. We started to actually practice with it some, but I want to name it now as a meditation practice for insight dialogue, a support for interpersonal meditation. So when I pause now, just listen, if you will, attune to the fact of impermanence within your own mind and in this world around you. So I'll just pause and sense into the changing, vibrating nature of things. At the very least, waiting or expecting me to say something more. The stirring of the senses, the stirring of the mind. So you're listening for the impermanence. So as I'm speaking now, and I'm inviting you to pay attention to me and even look at me if you'd like, you know, if you'd like to do that. So like as I move my hand across the screen, my Thai teacher Ajahn Sobhan used to do this. He'd say, okay, so where's the hand that was here? Where's the hand that was here? You just point to how it's vanishing, right? And it's like that. So as I'm speaking now, just noticing that each word that I'm saying, as soon as I complete it, it's just gone. Gone. So I am now, let's say, a manifester of something impermanent for the benefit of your practice. I'm talking, and it's all vanishing. Gone, gone, gone. Look at the other side of it. As I'm speaking, it's all coming into being. This word, this word, this word, it's just coming out. My hand is just moving. Just the world blossoming up into this moment. Emergent. Pay attention to how your body feels right now. I'll stop for a moment, noticing the body sitting, your body. And the emergent experience of there is a body constantly rising up. Now, now, a flow. Listening to that flow. So the Buddha speaks of noticing the rising, the vanishing, and both the rising and vanishing. That's in the Satipatthana Sutta and a lot of other places. So this is attuned to emergence is the, in the moment of your practice, when you pause and you bring the contemplation to mind and you open, you're with your partner, pause, relax, open, and here you are. What's emergent in this mind right now? And then of this, what do I speak? You know, when you offer the contemplation, there's an emergent response in the body-mind. What am I going to speak? So actually practice like that, right? Rather than just have a thinking session with the contemplation that I'm going to offer. Thinking sessions, when they're good Dhamma, is still a practice of right view. It still has right mindfulness. It's good practice. But this is, in some ways, better. You know, having the actual meditative element strengthens the inquiry. Gives you a continuity of sati also. So attuned to emergence is the key to your, that you offer to yourself. Attune as in listen for, or sensitize to this rising and vanishing. Don't know mind. You don't know what's going to come up next. That's what happens at the edge of the moment. You lose your presumptions, your assumptions fall apart, and you have don't know mind. Wow, that's wonderful. So now your contemplation, and you'll once again have groups of three, and you'll go for, I'd like to give you plenty of time for the whole group without taking turns. So let's start with taking turns so you can, you know, really hone your practice. Let's do 4-4-4, and then let's do 8-4-4-4-8. So before I restate the contemplation, there's one more thing I want to point out about the attuning to emergence. Like I was giving you the opportunity, and you can use it now as I'm speaking, to notice the rising and vanishing as I'm speaking, like right now, this experience. So as I said, I'm a manifester of something that you can observe, this, the anicca, and attuned to emergence, be at the edge of experience because I'm doing all this talking and moving and so on. When you're in insight dialogue and your partner is speaking, they are giving you that gift. So not only are you really meditating with attuned to emergence, pause, relax, open, attuned to emergence internally, but externally as well. Okay? So, the contemplation now is, where do you notice in your life this manifesting of right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi? It's that simple. But, and that includes formal practice, by the way. It's not only formal practice. And this aspect of right effort that I'm pointing to, we know that it's already like in your formal meditation practice, the effort to cultivate the wholesome, you're cultivating the wholesome with, let's say, metta practice as well as mindfulness practice and so on. But let's look at the abandoning of the already arisen unwholesome. In other words, where are the psychological structures being released? That's part of the path. Formally, exactly. It's part of effacement. When the project is construed as making a better self, you've just lost so much. But when you see that it's a process of coming to see things as they are, of letting go, very different matter. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi in your life. And as you listen, and as you speak, specifically practicing supported by pause, relax and receive, open into the relational, spacious, and right here, give attention to attune to emergence. The rising and vanishing, the don't know mind, right here. Attune to emergence. So let's talk a little bit about how those path factors are functioning for you and whether attuning to emergence as a practice feels alive for you. Any observations on right effort, right mindfulness? Right, samadhi as a living path. Yeah, Justin.
Thank you. I've been reading a lot about right effort and the various things that the Buddha will recommend that you do to approach and abandon those unwholesome thoughts. Mm-hmm. And some I prefer over others, but I try them all. But, you know, you were asking kind of, it seems to me like you bringing this whole Eightfold Path into my daily life and into everything I'm doing. The thing that I struggle with most is worry. That's my hindrance of choice. And I'm constantly trying to redirect myself and bring those unwholesome, worrisome thoughts into perspective and hopefully abandon them. I am really curious about, I'm always looking for techniques by which to approach them. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, so this is turning more into a question, I suppose, but like recommendations that you have, and you're giving some already. Can you elaborate more on those ideas? Mm-hmm. The things that I tend to do and are to do a lot of body scans and a lot of feeling my body, trying to get out of my head. Mm-hmm. trying to and then of course opening my mind up to others and metta,
right?
And I'm just looking for any and all tools that you might recommend.
Yeah, I love the open mind.
I'm very grateful for the whole purpose of what you're teaching today. And I really enjoyed the first two chapters of your book, and I look forward to reading the rest of it as well. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks, Justin. Yeah, let me address that as we go forward rather than right now, because it's such it's an enormous and very wonderful question. Yeah.
Okay, I look forward to it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and then we'll have two more and then we'll continue. Francisca?
Yes, I was going to say that in my practice, I only have 2 years. My mindfulness was going right on the cushion, but not outside of the cushion. So in my intention to have a right effort, I started to do walking meditation. So I was able to bring my mindfulness outside and with movement and doing things, and that has been going right. But when you talk about the samadhi or right concentration, I've been unable to get there, or I don't know how to spot it, or I don't know if that's something how can I get it, or know if I'm doing it. So that's something I would like to ask.
Wonderful.
If you could explain. Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you. And again, I'll address that in just a moment. And Mary.
I think I want your counsel on this. I chose the email specifically so that I could print them out and use them after class is over. And it occurs to me, you know, my inner dialogue is ordinarily pretty negative. And I never know if I am in aversion, trying to get rid of them, or if I, you know, I know when I succumb and everything, but it occurred to me while going through these things today that what I would like to do is when I see myself filled with ill will or see any of the hindrances attacking me, I'm going to refer back to one of these things and simply replace it with working on one of these questions. Is that skillful or not?
Actually, it was one of the strategies I was going to speak about with Justin on Justin's behalf. So thank you, Mary. Yeah, that's good. So let's talk about this a little bit. Let me start with Francesca's question about samadhi. So formal samadhi practice, as you know, reaches into the highest levels of the sort of the Buddhist meditative atmosphere now and here in this particular retreat experience that we're having, going into the more refined samadhi practices there's not time, it's not the right place. However, if you do happen to read the Whole Life Path book, the chapter on samadhi is pretty, you know, covers practice pretty well. And if from a different light than I think that you get in a certain, you know, in other places, it, you know, works with the existing samadhi literature, I think, in a helpful way. But the piece that we can talk about is if we look at the question, why is samadhi so difficult for us? Why does the mind always want to jump everywhere, even when we make time on retreat? It's still difficult. What gives? And when you read the discourses and you see, you know, say someone like not only Sariputta, but the Buddha speaking about, you know, the measure of a kind of a, you know, a generally good monastic life, that one can attain at will any of these meditative qualities, meditative states. It's like, wait a minute. And, you know, that would also, by the way, include jhana, like real absorption, like the deepest samadhi. How is that possible? We say, from where we sit, like, I couldn't do that. And I'll be frank with you. I can't just sit down instantly, you know, drop into jhana. I need time and space for it. And reflecting on this question, you know, for quite a long time, I came to realize that the people who were doing that, not only do they, you know, let's say have certain meditative attainment due to, you know, some prolonged periods of practice, they live differently. So where I might take, you know, days, weeks, or months for the body mind to down-regulate so that those absorbed states can have a chance to arise, such down-regulation, such a high level of, or such a strong need for down-regulation is not present if you're living a life not only of morality, but simplicity. And we're not doing that. Most of us are not. I'm not. And so when we think about a whole life path perspective then on Sama Samadhi, we're called to look at the ways that we set our lives up for stress, or more positively, to look at how can I encourage in my life times of tranquility, ways of approaching the things that I do or must do with greater calm, and the actual living environment and schedules, and you know, the very practical stuff that in aggregate makes such a difference in our access to tranquility, pasadi, and concentration, if you will, stillness, samadhi. So getting back to Francesca's question, look at in your life the places of stress and say, you know, is there a different way to do this? Is there another way to structure it? Look at your daily schedule. Is there any time set aside to just be, to relax, to settle down? Or are we always filling up our time? Look at the use of entertainment. Look at the kinds of foods that you eat and beverages you drink, like caffeinated beverages and so on. These are very simple, mundane questions. It doesn't take rocket science to, you know, to see that the impact of the ways that we live. And now in a, you know, culture that's so sped up by way of the internet, then of course it just takes all of that and amps it up further. This question that was asked, you know, is it, you know, if I take these questions that were just emailed or texted to me and use them when my mind is going in a critical, dark way, is that skillful? Absolutely. That's refuge in the Dhamma. That's the technical term for what you're doing, refuge in the Dhamma. You're taking refuge in the Dhamma rather than refuge in your fabricating, worrying, constructing mind and mind states. So, Justin, the kinds of, you know, worries that come up are obsessive. Bring in the Dhamma. What Dhamma is going to serve you there? The Buddha speaks about this particular aspect of it, of replacing an unwholesome thought with a wholesome thought. And he likens it to, you know, you've got a peg, because they didn't have nails back then, right? And you drive one peg out with another peg. It's like that. But I would like to note that this is exactly one of these beautiful multi, you know, win-win-win situations where you're practicing right view, You're practicing right effort to abandon the unwholesome, and you're practicing the right effort to cultivate the wholesome. You know, you talked about bringing in metta to do this. The whole of the Dhamma works for this. So let me give you an example. And this is a great practice for anyone, anytime. The Buddha taught about the, you know, he had a kind of a schema. There's a whole bunch of suttas where he talks about this, one after the other. Gratification, danger, and escape. So, for example, in this worrying state that Justin was talking about, that I think we can all relate to in one way or another, ask yourself right then, what is the gratification in my worrying about this? I must be getting something out of doing this, or my mind wouldn't do it. Why am I doing this? Good question. Maybe we think we can solve the problem by worrying about it. So we worry about it. So there's gratification. Well, what's the danger? Like, how can this go badly? Well, the obsession itself increases suffering and leads to a kind of a patterning of the mind towards stress, so we know that it won't support samadhi in the future, by the way. But also, you know, wherever the mind is clinging to something, whatever it is we're worrying about, or whatever we're threatened by, or whatever feeling of fear, or something we don't feel up to a task, we feel inadequate or something, unworthy, or perhaps, though, you know, whatever those psychological patterns are behind the worry, there's a danger there. They're being not only the immediate suffering, but we're conditioning the future with that kind of those patterns. What's the escape? The two primary answers to that are the abandoning of the hunger or the lust or the holding that's behind the worry, right? So that's not so easy, right? I mean, easier said than done, right? But at least look at, there's something there that's not abandoned, and that perspective might be a helpful one. It might not, but it might be. And the other escape, if you will, and not in the sense of like trying to avoid, but the escape, like really getting free of that pattern, is, here we are, the Noble Eightfold Path. So scan the path factors in the moment that you're worrying and say, okay, how can the path help me right now? And just go through each of the path factors. Check out what view is operating. How can I cultivate right view? Obviously, you know, some sort of delusion is going on. There's something going on, right? Right intention. Where are the unwholesome intentions here? How can I cultivate wholesome intentions? And, right speech. Is there a speech thing that's coming out of this worry? How can I cultivate wholesome speech? Right action. Is there any action coming out of here? Any action involved in this? Any action that's planned? What's wholesome? What's the moral relationship to this thing that I'm worried about? Or that whatever's obsessing my mind. Justin mentioned worry, but we all have minds that get obsessed. Right livelihood. Not only how I'm earning money, how I'm getting resources in, how am I spending my resources in ways that relates to this thing I'm worrying about, or this general state of worry or stress or fear or doubt, whatever the psychological sort of spinning might be. Right effort. So how can right effort help me now? Am I bringing forward energy, wholesome energy, balanced energy, the right effort to calm down. That's also right effort. Right effort is not always like, you know, like making more of. Right effort to cultivate, which you, you know, Justin said he had done with the metta and so on. That's a cultivating the wholesome. Right mindfulness. How's that operating now? Am I worrying? Am I stressed? Am I in doubt and fear and not aware of what's going on? How can the mindfulness come in? And then the right sama samadhi, which is going to be particularly challenging at that point because the mind is agitated. And that's okay. That is not a problem. You got 7 other path factors to work with. Don't worry about samadhi all the time. It's a big deal in certain circumstances. In certain circumstances, it really doesn't matter that much. That's how the path is, you know? It's got doorways everywhere, every moment. That's the lesson here, you know? That's the message of our time together. The path is always available, always operating. Get to know it well enough to do what we just did in a moment, and it will serve you very well, very, very well. So let's talk about that. So there you were, out in your lives, getting these text messages, which is, you know, having the support of spiritual friends to, you know, kind of keep the path alive. But when we're out there in daily, everyday life, what are the things that really somehow seem to fall off the path? That's where these factors I just mentioned of right action and right livelihood, right living, come in. So let's touch into that because it's super powerful in this practice of effacement and towards this sense of the path always on. So right action. All action. All action, every action we take can be understood, framed by the Noble Eightfold Path. That's amazing. That should be giving you some comfort, because if you're ever thinking the path is distant, just look at what you're actually doing. Action. Now, the classical right action is, you know, like the 5 precepts, you know, non-killing or harming, non-harming, right? And non-stealing, not taking what's not given, and proper engagement with sexuality, with intoxicants, with speech. That's classic, like that's the core. But when you realize that we're talking about the totality of my actions, and that my actions place me in a human web. Do you see that right action is a relational path factor, just like right speech? It's all about how you relate to other people. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood are all about how we relate to others and to society. So in whole, you could say these are right relation, you know? That's what sila is. So one of the practices that I talk about in the book with each path factor is a path factor inventory. You know, and in the case of right action, let's just check that out now. How am I living? How am I acting in the world? Actions of speech are largely covered by right speech, but let's include them here in right action again. How am I acting in relation to sexuality? How am I relating to other people as far as harm, non-harm, helping prevent harm, helping diminish harm. How am I acting in the world with regards not taking what is rightful, if you will, not stealing? And, you know, in a large, complex economy, right livelihood and right not stealing for right action, these are very complex things. Because as soon as you use American dollars, you know, one could argue that theft is going on from other countries where their resources are being, you know, extracted. As soon as you enter the banking system, not simple. These simple, simple path factors are not so simple. And non-harming, non-killing. If I engage this path factor inventory for right action, how am I doing when it comes to honoring life and non-harming beings? And you can take that from the very simply, I don't literally go to kill beings. And you can look at how the things that we do may or may not be harmless in the world. So this is a place where practice looks like life change, you know? It's not just practice on a cushion, it's how am I behaving? Right livelihood. So, we know that any livelihood that is going to contribute to harming beings, like manufacturing weapons or alcohol or, you know, being an actual mercenary or, you know, something that directly involves killing or stealing, we know that, okay, wrong livelihood. And that was the Buddha's most simple definition. What is right livelihood? Avoiding wrong livelihood. He said stuff like that, you know. But beyond not dealing in poisons, weapons, you see, if we're spending so many hours a day doing something like a profession, how does that impress, how does our actions and our environment, our relationships within that, impress themselves on the mind? If I have to, for example, in my job, tell little lies all day. Wow. Uh-oh. I think that's a problem, right? In terms of mental patterns. Or if I am required, if you will, not required, but the circumstances seem to demand unkindness, insensitivity. Or maybe my job involves something that is, you know, a type of theft of some sort, like I mentioned the resources earlier. But I suggest that there's a great power in this path factor to just flood through our lives in a wholesome way when we recognize that right livelihood, just as it includes the bringing in of resources, includes how we spend the resources. It's the movement of resources. So now your credit card statement is a moral document. The way that you use the requisites, and I talk about this a fair bit in the book, the monks and the nuns, they've got all kinds of rules about the requisites of clothing, shelter, food, and medicine. What do we have as lay people? Not much guidance, really. So I unpack the requisites in terms of right livelihood and just ask ourselves, how are we using resources in our food? Where does this food come from? Is it ethically raised? Who picks those strawberries? And how are they treated? Shelter. Is this a wise use of resources? Is it enough? Is it too much? What's the impact? I mean, we're talking about a climate crisis. This is where the path crosses the climate crisis in right livelihood. But rather than just have that be a nice thing to notice in a Dhamma talk, how do I practice? Well, do a path factor inventory on right livelihood. How's my shelter? How's my food? Transportation? Clothing? What's ethical? So now, next time you're out, like buying groceries or buying clothing, the Noble Eightfold Path is right there with you. No problem. It's always there. Not as like a some sort of, you know, sort of harsh judgment of your choices, as a place of waking up and reflecting and making wise choices. We have enough of the kind of moralistic attitudes that have been associated with religion and then just lead to harmful judgment of self and others and both. It's not helpful. This is a reflection on cause and effect. What is my relationship with, let's say, how much clothing I buy or what the clothing is? Just to take that one requisite. And now, do I see what the impact on the mind is? The kind of, oh, well, you know, this looks nice on me. That's all very well and good. If there's a self component, maybe, in what looks nice on you, that's really not so bad. That's just kind of normal. But, like, if I've gotten some exotic cloth or something that is manufactured by people who are underpaid by effectively slave labor, then this becomes a moral decision as well. and so on. So the ways that we engage the path are just enormously expanded with right speech and action and livelihood. Always around us, always surrounding us. So let's ask ourselves, do I feel inspired to really look at the stuff of my life, my job, how I spend money, how I eat, when I think about my Noble Eightfold Path? Does that feel right? Does it feel true? Does it feel like, oh wow, so I could actually become more mindful as I attune to this, so I could actually feel more at peace and more compassionate? All of this stuff that we're talking about, diminishing harm for oneself, for others, and for both, all of it. And all of it involves some degree of mindfulness, some degree of effort, some wise understanding, some right view. All of it fits in with the intentions of the mind, right intention, where's the aim of my life? And you feel, oh wow, if I start giving attention to my use of resources or to my job or to how I'm treating people, how I speak, if I start giving attention to that, then the quality of my life changes, and all of this pulls me out of self-centeredness. Because as long as I'm self-centered, I will not care about any of this. It just doesn't matter, because what matters is getting, you know, the pleasures that I get from these things, these ways that I spend my money or these actions I take, I come first, you know, that kind of attitude. So do you see now we're back where we started, which is quite intentional, at effacement. These practices diminish self-centeredness. Why was Dana giving, named repeatedly by the Buddha as the entryway to the path, so that he could earn a good living? I don't think so. He didn't need it. Dana is a practice of effacement. It's like the giving, and someone else is more important in that moment than me. I'm not holding for me. I'm giving to you. And it's like you can almost feel the barriers of self break down. And it makes, you know, it just lubricates life with, you know, bathes it in goodness from a standpoint.